My name is Ray Lee. I'm so honored to have been given this role to MC this panel and introduce these amazing organizers from across the country. Can we please give a warm round of welcome? Woo! Okay. So I'm gonna just provide a quick context about BDS and then introduce our panelists one by one. So I guess I should introduce myself first. I'm a member of the newly formed Seattle Against War, our current, thank you. Yeah. Our current campaign target is Representative Adam Smith, who is a ranking member of House Armed Services Committee. He's a war profiteer, and he's been paid to do nothing to stop the flow of our tax dollars and weapons to the genocidal Israeli regime. Boo! Down. Yeah, but this is actually not the war profiteer panel. It's the panel about the growing divestment from genocide movement. So modeled after the anti-apartheid movement against the apartheid-era South African government, since 2005, Palestinians have been leading the worldwide boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign against Israel for its human rights violations, and as a very successful economic pressure strategy. The goal here is to put strain on Israeli economic, academic, and cultural institutions, as well as non-Israeli entities that are complicit in normalizing this genocidal regime. So here in the belly of the beast, in a monopoly capitalist system that devalues Palestinian lives and whose institutions, from city councils and companies to universities and pension funds, they sustain the war machine and legitimize this genocide. So it is our collective work to cut off the economic power at the source. BDS campaigns have won hundreds of victories in the US alone. Today, we will get to hear from organizers who represent organizations fighting for divestment from across the country who have led and successfully implemented these strategies, joining the worldwide solidarity movement to isolate and drain the strength of the Israeli regime. So, from left to right, we have Zhenya, who is a member of the Anti-War Committee Chicago, refounded a year ago to join the fight to end all US aid to Israel, organized the march on the DNC, and stand in solidarity with movements for Palestinian liberation and all those of working and oppressed people. AWC Chicago is organizing to end the investment of Illinois public funds into Israeli occupation and genocide. Can we give a please big welcome? Okay. Next, we have Shreyas, who is from the New Orleans Stop Helping Israel's Ports, or No Ship, founded in November 2023. They oppose trade agreements between Port of New Orleans and Port of Ashdod in occupied Palestine. No Ship quickly expanded to broader BDS work, seeking to end all aid, as well as cultural and economic ties between NOLA and Israel. No Ship is also a leading member of the New Orleans Palestine Coalition, starting in fall 2024, so please give them a wonderful welcome. Next up is Jackson. Jackson is a member of Detroit Anti-War Committee, founded in May 2024. Yeah. Woo. From several student organizations who wanted to take the energy of the encampment movement and put it into the community. Detroit Anti-War Committee is now organizing around getting Detroit to divest from war profiteers and apartheid Israel. So give them a warm welcome. All right, next up, Ali is representing San Jose Against War, campaigning for San Jose City Council to divest from Israel and the corporations profiting from Israeli apartheid and its genocidal war on Palestine. She's also part of the group China Is Not Our Enemy. Please give her a big applause. Last but not least, we have Lena, who is a member of the Minnesota Anti-War Committee, whose main campaign has focused on fighting for the Minnesota State Board of Investments to completely divest from Israel and the corporations profiting from Israel's apartheid regime. Please give a huge, huge applause. So our first question, and we're going to pass the mic down the line after each question, okay? How did your committee decide the target of your divestment campaign? Zhenya?
All right. So I'm based in Chicago, we're in Illinois, and we started doing research during the summer as we were preparing for the March on DNC on the various sources of Illinois funding being invested in Israel. And It was through research and also consultation with allies, the U.S. Palestinian Community Network, and also the Minnesota Anti-War Committee that we initially found three main potential targets. That was the state treasurer, Michael Frerichs. It was the Illinois State Board of Investments, which is a statewide pension board, and then also Chicago Pension Board. And one of the, I guess, qualifications that we were looking for is an elected official, because we were really inspired by the student movement, but we also saw how school administrators were not accountable to the students, and not that elected officials are incredibly accountable either, but we have a little bit more leverage there. So that was one thing that we were looking for. We were also looking for public funds and ensuring that we could mobilize everyone in Illinois around this. The treasurer ended up being a really compelling target because he had sole control over investment in Israeli bonds, which basically go into Israel's general budget. He was very ideologically in support of Israel. He was saying, we're investing in our Israeli friends. He was saying, this is the only democracy in the Middle East. And he was also incredibly forward. Yeah, it was horrible. Incredibly forward about the actual numbers that he was investing and putting it out in press releases and bragging about it. Whereas the pension board, we realized pretty early on it would take a much longer time to research. And so we wanted to basically be able to jump into the wave of mobilization happening around Palestine pretty immediately, start organizing around that, but then on the side continue to do research around the pension board. And then it was also really advantageous because he's the vice president of the pension board and he barely has any public events, but he has to be there every single time, even though he's already broken that. And so we knew that on a quarterly basis, we could find him and pressure him. And then I guess I'll also mention too that we had to analyze whether or not we could take on a statewide campaign as a newer organization. And there were a few factors that made us realize that we thought we could take on a statewide campaign, which is that we're in Chicago, that's 40% of the state's population. To win statewide office, you do need to carry Chicago. It's a huge center of people's movements. And then also as we started organizing, we initially did a lot of coalition work and a lot of solidarity work. And so only launching our own campaign months into the existence of the organization. And so that basically ensured like we can build statewide to build power for this campaign. And yeah, I think that's it for me.
After October 7 in New Orleans, there started being protests happening regularly with a lot of turnout. There was a lot of energy. And there were some like existing non-Palestine focused organizations that were calling them, but the need to develop organizations, to have leadership, and to be able to generate long-term campaigns was quickly apparent. So in November, basically we found the target for our divestment campaign by Googling New Orleans, Israel. And the first thing that came up was a trade agreement between the Port of New Orleans, a bunch of big local NGOs or nonprofits, but they're all like business focused, and the Port of Ashdod in Israel. And it was a really good target because especially at that time, it was clear that ports were going to be institutions for people to mobilize around. And another thing was that our port had monthly public board meetings. So that also allowed for a way to organize actions where people are like, have a target that they can go and tangibly speak in front of and lay demands in front of. So that has been ongoing since. No Ship is still going to every single port meeting since, I guess, December of 2023. And since then, our purview has expanded greatly. So we were one of a few Palestine organizations that formed in New Orleans after October 7. New Orleans has a huge Palestinian community. Previously, there was like a solidarity coalition. They had been working on a human rights ordinance for the city to pass. It won't do business with companies that are engaged in human rights violations. And so it didn't say Israel in the ordinance, right? Then they passed it. And then the Federation became aware of it and immediately got the city council to repeal it at the next meeting. So that had killed the coalition at the time of, by the time of October 7, actually way before October 7. So since then, like a new coalition has formed that before then, new organizations formed. And so there's been a lot of different campaigns that have come out of it. There's a few different focuses. And within No Ship, our focus has also expanded. So we were doing the ceasefire work regularly, which also helped grow the movement and also helped turn attention towards the port as well, because we were visible there. And another thing is that the focus on the port allowed us to then later on be able to do the research on like how many weapons are going through the port of New Orleans and like even greater ties to Israel than what we had initially found. And the port is just something that is involved in so many different ways that it just became a good target to stick with and like center in our work.
Yeah, so once again, I'm Jackson with Detroit Anti-War Committee. So to answer the question why we chose to pick divestment as the target of our campaign was, yeah, we came out of the student movement. You know, many of our early leaders were leaders of the encampment, whether it was on security, whether it was guiding, you know, political decisions. And so we took our similar demands that we were waging against the school and decided to take that energy into the community. You know, Wayne State at one point at our encampment had 600 people. And so we recognized that energy was there and we wanted to continue it. And our thought process was to do the most damage against apartheid Israel. We got to hit them where it hurts, and that's their wallets. So we started a divestment campaign. We started going to city council and harassing our city councilors and showing that there's people who, you know, want them to do real change that affects their community. We did a bunch of firing campaigns and would go around to our riverfront, would go to different neighborhoods, and we would talk to people. And we would say, you know, shouldn't the city of Detroit be investing in our communities instead of war and genocide? And it really, really resonated with people. You know, in a city like Detroit that's 77% Black and hugely underfunded, Detroit schools are underfunded, people realize that this is something that deeply affects them, that their tax dollars, whether it's sales tax, property tax, or income tax, is going to buy guns for people who want to kill children. And it really, really hit home for people that they would rather have that money be invested in local businesses and anything else that, you know, could materially help people. And that was the big pickup of our campaign that really built us a connection to our community that we, before that, you know, didn't have. So that was the broad reason why we chose it, is because we wanted to connect with our community. We were from the student movement and we wanted to take that energy and show these people in so-called Israel that we're going to hit them where it hurts, and that's their wallets.
Hi, I'm Allie with San Jose Against War. San Jose is based in the San Francisco Bay Area. And so for us, when we were starting, we looked to South African apartheid and the divestment movements there. And the success of those movements taught us that some of the most impactful targets would be universities and government. Most of us were out of school, so that left us with a government target. And in determining a government target, we decided on the city of San Jose as opposed to the county or the state, because there's a precedent for other divestment campaigns against Israel succeeding at the municipal level in the Bay Area, such as Hayward and Richmond. We chose San Jose because that's where most of our members are based and where we are holding most of our actions. And to start, we pulled the city's financial reports to see what company San Jose is invested in, and we cross-referenced these against companies on the BDS list. And this is how we knew that San Jose has nearly $55 million directly invested in companies complicit in Israel's genocide, and that our city's investment portfolio comes up for an annual vote every March. So then we drafted the petition, and we did this by pulling other cities' petitions for inspiration and to ensure our messages were online, and then we just tweaked it to apply to San Jose.
Hi, so I'm with the Minnesota Anti-War Committee, and our campaign targets the Minnesota State Board of Investments. The SBI is a state body that manages investments for state retirement funds and pensions. We're tracking about $5.4 billion that are being invested in entities that are complicit in and or profiting from Israeli apartheid. Yeah. We chose the SBI as our target for a few reasons. Our strategy for divestment is explicitly built around our community, and more specifically on mass mobilization. We don't believe politicians come to correct ethical decisions out of the goodness of their hearts. Otherwise, the sheer scale of the genocide we've seen inflicted upon Palestinians over the last several months would have been more than enough to move them by now. We're not focused on asking them to hear us out. Instead, we focus our energy on increasing our volume to make sure that we cannot be ignored. Because the SBI makes all Minnesota taxpayers complicit in Israel's crimes through its investments, our target allows us to connect to average Minnesotans and get them involved with our campaign, or at least interested in it. And because the SBI claims that their investments are for the sake of pensioners, we're also able to seamlessly connect with organized labor groups and unionists who have already fought hard to earn these pensions and who ultimately wield the political leverage to demand that their pensions can be a source of pride, not money made from investments in apartheid. The SBI is also a very specific target. It's local. The board members have names that people know. The board's chaired by, maybe you've heard of him, maybe you've been arrested on his front lawn, Tim Walz. A lot of times, yeah, boo for him, right? A lot of times, organizing against US imperialism can feel nebulous and hopeless. So our campaign provides the average Minnesotan with tangible proximity, not just to the complicity, but also to the means of bringing on real material change. That proximity provides the fuel that allows us to continue filling the streets and the SBI's spaces, inboxes, front lawns, etc. It allows people to relate to the fight in a way that doesn't feel self-defeating and paralyzing. It provides a direct means to take action. Another reason we locked in on the SBI is because we know they can divest. In 1985, the SBI began to divest from apartheid South Africa because of pressure from organizers in the Twin Cities. So we know they can do it, and we're gonna make them do it again.
All right, second question for the panelists. What have been the hurdles or difficulties your committee has faced in your campaign, and how did you deal with them?
All right, so I think I'll also start with saying our campaign started in September, and so we're still dealing with a lot of these and figuring out how to navigate them. The first thing that we struggled with, even after we ended up settling on our targets, was just even where to start within the state. And so we ended up doing a lot of research on Friedrichs, just looking at elections, looking at centers of support, looking at his campaign endorsers and funders, looking at, you know, points of leverage. And that helped us narrow down, like, what are the constituencies? What are the even labor unions? Where geographically do we need to focus first on building organizational allies? We also struggled and are still struggling and figuring this out, just how to navigate, I guess, the finances and the economics of it all, especially with focusing primarily on Friedrichs, who is investing in bonds, and then also secondarily with the State Board of Investments, which is investing a different pot of money. We needed to do a lot of public education within our organization and with our allies. We ended up doing a number of trainings on bonds, but realized that we needed to do this on a very repetitive basis as we had new members coming in. We needed to develop education materials, so now we're creating a fact sheet. But then we also realized that the deeper we understand the financial aspects of this, the more it can set our campaign strategy and the more it can give us space to push back on our targets. And so recently, the state treasurer put out a press release that he was renewing $15 million in Israeli bonds. And his press release was so much more defensive than previous ones. It was a lot less ideological, and it was basically responding to seemingly a lot of our talking points, point by point. And at first, it seemed really intimidating, but once we started to analyze the press release, we actually saw that it really showed that he was buying bonds to prop up Israel at the expense of Illinois taxpayers. And so we immediately started to put those talking points out there and just making sure that, you know, not only do we have the people's movements on our side, but we're also able to meet them on their terrain and push back, really not give them any wiggle room. Oh, and then I think another challenge that we struggled with is we had to do so much research. We were also trying to bring in organizations around the state level that we found that research and the coalition work was just taking up an incredible amount of energy at the cost of neglecting our mass work. And then this was coinciding with a lull in organizing activity, I think broadly. And so we realized we needed to like start quickly bringing in people with actions and bring up the energy levels, reduce bottlenecks in our organization. And shortly after that, we had organized an action at the Illinois State Board of Investments. We had also done a banner drop, and we saw that there was a renewed energy and enthusiasm around our work. And then lastly, we are just dealing with harsh, you know, weather conditions in Chicago, and so we ended up front-loading a lot of our petition gathering and our outreach, and now we're using that list to recruit to our current actions, but then also thinking about other things we can do more remotely. So we've been doing calling campaigns, and then we also had a banner drop that resulted in a big boost of petition signatures. So that's one way we have been navigating that.
So I have a list of challenges that we faced. I'll start with ones that we have actually dealt with. The first thing that I think we confronted was like when all of this energy was first being generated, there was a lot of actions taking place, a need, a desire to be holding actions all the time. There was a lot of like research, so many connections that people were figuring out, eager to figure out and put out there for the first time. And like one of the things that became clear was that we need structure like within the organization, right? So like breaking one first thing is having a steering committee that is accountable to like lead the organization and make sure that the work is actually moving forward. And then the other thing is breaking the organization into different like subcommittees. And so that helped us manage the campaigns that we were a part of because it was truly like a lot of different things happening at once. For example, the ongoing port actions that were happening every month, as well as going to the city council to demand the ceasefire that was happening for like 7 or 8 months straight every 2 weeks. And then I guess the second hurdle or difficulty was the Jewish Federation, which was the cause of the city council like fighting back against the human rights ordinance after they had initially passed it back in 2018. Obviously, so the Federation, if folks don't know, is like the most, one of the biggest like Israel advertisers in this country. They organize birthright trips. If you go on their website, you'll see some of the most appalling things that you'll ever see. And if you go to your local Federation, you'll meet some of the most appalling people you've ever met. And so initially, like we didn't want to target them straight up because we were just forming and they are very powerful. And I think one of their former CEOs was also a city council member in New Orleans, for example. So that just shows you the level of access. And similarly with our congressman is super entrenched with the Zionist lobby as well. So they basically stepped in and the last minute when our city council had been, like we had been kind of forcing them to introduce something on the agenda for a ceasefire resolution. They stepped in. They hadn't come to any meeting to speak on their issues. They just have backdoor access and they forced the city council to pass a statement of peace instead of a ceasefire resolution condemning the division or the war, which it's not even a war. So what did we do? We started targeting them and they had an annual fundraiser that happened last December. And we held a noise demonstration outside of it. And it was really awesome, both for the participants, but also awesome seeing how they reacted to us. They didn't know what to do. And so yeah, definitely encourage just confronting people like these head on. Another difficulty or outside obstacle that we faced are the police. So the police at the local university, Tulane University, which is an extremely Zionist institution, the campus police are even worse than like the city police. They don't meet the standards of the city police even. And so they were starting to arrest people and just very like confrontational. The Tulane students weren't allowed basically to even hold protests and it required community support for them to be able to hold protests. And then people started getting arrested by the Tulane police, by the port police, and by NOPD during the encampment. And what we did was we mobilized around that, right? We had defense campaigns going immediately and people showing up to every single hearing. And every single case that has been heard thus far, the charges have been dropped or we've been found, not dropped, not guilty, which is even better. And in fact, just this week, a student, a PhD student at Tulane, who was arrested days after the encampment as he was getting out of public transport all alone for participating in the encampment and was facing felony charges, 3 years in prison, he got found not guilty and he got an apology from the judge that even had to deal with this. So, yeah, so that has been super, super energizing for our movement. But then there's been like other challenges that we are unable to cross. The first thing is how impermeable institutions still are. I think someone was saying this earlier, not focusing on trying to be heard out by these people. Yeah, the people that we have in Louisiana aren't going to hear us out. And so we're still going to try. But then because of that, like the public actions, like showing up in the streets or the demonstrations become even more important. Because if we're not able to apply pressure from within, then we're just going to show you how unpopular your decisions are, how unpopular you are. And so something like when it comes to be election time, which it is this year for the city council, that's something that we can leverage against them. Another challenge that we faced was like interorganizational conflict, corrosive behaviors, which I think is pretty common in leftist organizing spaces. And one thing that we applied is like having the direct criticism and self-criticism be a part of our meetings. Not that we do it every meeting, but folks know that like the best way to address conflict is directly with each other. After having a few bad experiences of like group chat fights, just people clashing because we're together so often. And it's like people are going through a lot, so this stuff happens. But we've taken each of those instances and like turned it into like having procedures for them, like a harm response form, bring your issues to the meeting, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so in Detroit, one of the biggest hurdles we faced was rather recent. So we had our council president, Madam Sheffield, who signed on to our resolution, said, let's do divestment together, let's work together. And that only came after, you know, I yelled at them at public comments, said they didn't know how to do their jobs. So, you know, they decided to work with us. And over the course of a couple weeks, they then, after the election of Donald Trump and a couple weeks past that, they said, you know what, we're no longer interested. And strung us along for weeks so we'd stop heckling them, stop, you know, being as antagonistic and softened us up. And it was difficult to, you know, then retort and come back, but we've been doing it. So we had a teach-in about Detroit Divest. And we pointed out the city council very clearly that they are the people we're opposing, they're the people we're organizing against, and they're the people that we're making demands of. And they're not our friends no matter what they want to say to us. They'll be our friends when they give us divestment. But before that, they're not our friends, and we're not going to treat them like it anymore. Paired with that, we then also had an email zap, and we blew up their inbox by sending them, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails saying, you know, why'd you reject it? Why did you drop this resolution? Why don't you care anymore? Why don't you care about your constituents? And that's starting to be more successful that then they've redirected us to their chief of staff and said, oh, no, talk to this guy. So then we blew up his inbox next. And now we're just keeping hassling them. So, you know, we're able to do a couple of things to overcome the hurdle. You know, we're now trying to get answers from the resolution and see why what happened. We're building new co-sponsors and reaching out to other city council people so that we can get an endorsement from them. And we've gone public saying, you know, we know what you're trying to do. We know that you're trying to silence our voices, and we're not going to let you.
So our divestment movement was launched in October of last year, so we're still also kind of a baby movement. But so far, the biggest hurdle I'd say, or we'd say, is the fear of retribution. So since we launched our divestment petition, we reached out to local mosques and Muslim and Arab-owned small businesses for endorsement. And we've come across several instances where decision makers held back from endorsing because of a very valid fear of being targeted. But more often than not, they were at least still willing to sign the petition as individuals. And so since then, we've expanded the focus to Jewish and Christian organizations, plus reaching out to anti-war, anti-imperialist, and pro-labor organizations. And so this has taught us there's a sense of safety and community in numbers. The more people that sign the petition, the more people who may have been hesitant before are willing to sign. The second big hurdle that we had was kind of a poor strategy. So initially, we also started with a ceasefire resolution, which was just a spontaneous action without a long-term strategy and popular support. So back in 2023, several of our members took part in an effort to get City Council to pass a ceasefire resolution. Major mistakes made here were not building a popular campaign with escalating pressure. We jumped right into organizing this one big mass mobilization at a City Council meeting. So we were focused too much on closed-door negotiations with City Council members. We didn't call out the material relationship San Jose had with Israel. And so we really had no leverage, which weakened our bargaining power. And after this mobilization, we let the momentum fizzle out. So the result was City Council releasing a very weak, unofficial statement taking a both sides position. It had no material impact, and it pleased no one. And I've actually checked the unofficial statement recently. It's since been bombed by Zionists with one of our PEP counselors, progressives. I love that term. Somebody else brought it up earlier. Progressives, except for Palestine. He actually agreed with some of the comments that were on. Yeah, not cool. So it was a very short-sighted strategy driven by spontaneous action and lacked ongoing escalating tactics. But instead of giving up, we pivoted and took the lessons that we learned with us, and we started our divestment campaign.
Yeah, so the SBR doesn't necessarily have any obligation to listen to its constituents. So one of our campaign's anchor points is the SBR's quarterly meetings, where they actually are forced to hear their constituents' comments on their investments. So our latest hurdle came right before the SBI's last quarterly meeting, where they pretty abruptly decided to hold the meeting on Zoom without giving anyone space for public comment. Yeah. If our campaign were focused solely on us chipping away at the board, that sort of development would be really devastating. But because our campaign was intentionally designed to be outwardly oriented and focused on growing the mass movement here, our tactics didn't really have to change. We're able to lean back on our community and avoid being totally immobilized because of that. Politicians plugging their ears doesn't make our community members any less activated by the work. And on the contrary, it actually emboldens them quite a bit. So in response to the SBI's virtualization of their last meeting, we're discussing ways that we can escalate. In addition to that, we've also organized an upcoming action that we're calling a State Board of Divestment meeting to give people that opportunity to speak, and we're going to make sure that there's press there to report on it.
All right, amazing. How have you built a movement for divestment in your community? Who have been your best partners?
So we primarily do this through mass mobilization and by bringing the campaign to large events and by making it our central campaign. Even if our actions aren't explicitly about divestment, we manage to tie divestment into whatever we're doing, whether that's through our speeches, slogans, posters, etc. This has the effect of, again, giving people a tangible, material means to get involved with anti-war organizing. It allows our marches to provide a catalyst for involvement rather than just a fleeting sense of catharsis. We also do a lot of outreach. We try to table as often as we can to reach folks that have no idea that the SBI even exists. We've held panels to draw in organized labor, groups working outside of the Twin Cities, and other organizations that just want to get involved with divestment. We try to get people confident in their ability to talk about the campaign so that we can continue to draw in new people. We recently started a statewide initiative to help small organizations outside of the cities build up divestment efforts in their communities to also show that this is a statewide demand. We've created pamphlets, we've published op-eds, and last year we launched a website. It's divestmn.com if you want to check it out, so that folks who can't necessarily make it to our actions still have the resources to educate themselves and folks in their circles, which has been especially handy outside of the Twin Cities trying to get their own communities involved in the campaign because they can just share those resources with their people. As far as partners go, we're very fortunate here in the Twin Cities to have so many progressive forces to ally with. The Free Palestine Coalition, a Palestinian-led group composed of many of these progressive forces, provides us with an avenue to work with other groups and their bases to drive home the connections between Palestinian liberation and domestic issues, something that's been especially pertinent with Trump's presidency. We know that Israel's Elbit Systems, Raytheon, and Lockheed Martin all manufacture weaponry and violent surveillance technology used by both Israel and Palestine and the Department of Homeland Security's at our border. We know that Motorola Solutions provides surveillance technology to the Israeli government and also to the COP cities propping up across the country. We know that General Dynamics' monstrous bunker-busting bombs dropped by Israel on displaced Palestinians wreak immeasurable havoc on the environment of our shared planet. We know that ICE agents and U.S. police have both been trained on violent tactics by the IDF. And we know that the SBI is investing Minnesota money into all of these forces. And we know it doesn't stop in Palestine or in the United States. We have an opportunity and an obligation as anti-imperialists to make sure these connections are clear. Having various progressive organizations as partners allows us to bridge the gaps that might exist between our bases and to mobilize more folks in our communities. Also, unionists. Unionists are, again, one of our natural allies in this campaign and a big perk to organizing around the SBI. Nothing makes politicians sweat like organized labor does, and we found, yeah. We found an incredible partnership with organized labor groups whose opinions, statements, resolutions all hold a lot of political sway, especially coming from laborers whose pensions are managed by the SBI.
So for us, after publishing our petition, we wanted to add credibility to our campaign by getting endorsements. So we reached out to local chapters of pro-Palestine, anti-imperialist, anti-war, pro-labor organizations, and also unions, and also local houses of worship. And then we wanted to focus on building that movement through word of mouth. So we did this by asking our endorsers to share our petition with their network, post on their social media pages, and in exchange, we would do the same for their campaigns. We'd also do individual outreach to people and organizations that are likely to support us. And also most notable among our partners has been CARE, or the Council on American Islamic Relations. People see CARE's endorsement and they trust that our petition is legit. Furthermore, CARE has welcomed us to flyer at their local ribbon cutting ceremony and their annual gala. And to add authority to our campaign, we also reached out to local politicians who are pro-Palestine, which are very rare to find and hard to find in Silicon Valley, but we were able to get a county supervisor and a former vice mayor. And then we continue to show up in solidarity for local marginalized communities and where they allow us to flyer to.
We've been able to build a movement by being constantly active and consistent. You know, we were only founded in May, and yet we became a bigger and bigger voice in Detroit and in the broad anti-war work. So, you know, we've been able to have marches of over 100 people at times. We've been able to have meetings. After our inauguration protest, we had a 35-person meeting, which was historic for us. And we've been able to also just be a broader part of our community, whether it's having art builds that people are able to come out to, whether that's tabling at Emo versus Goth Night at Leland City Club. We love Goths for Gaza in Detroit. Yeah. And it's aided in our recruitment. And a bunch of people come out and want to be part of the movement because we know, you know, we're not just some stuffy people who want to sit in a room and talk ideology. We're a group of doers who want to do stuff. And it makes people want to join us. So that's how we, in broad part, have built a movement around the city. You know, people now reach out to us. We had a Doctors Against Genocide protest, and they reached out to us and said, you know, we don't know about that much about organizing in the city of Detroit itself. We want to reach out to you guys in your city. And we took that as a huge sign of respect, and we really appreciated it. So, you know, to move on with that, our best partners, I'd have to say one of them is U.S.-Palestinian Community Network. They've gotten Dearborn to divest and start the process of divestment, which is historic, which is huge. You know, they're a city of over 100,000 people. So if a city of over 100,000 people is starting the process of divestment, that's historic. So they've given us a bunch of advice about how to go about divestment. And they also now, you know, they show up to our protests. They support us. They sponsor our events, whether that's J20, whether that's, you know, the inauguration. And they've been huge allies to us in our work.
So to be like as concise as possible, the thing that's helped us the most is literally since October 7, the Palestinians have forced a lot of people in their world, like the positions of people in this world, to crystallize. And what I mean by that is that it's even more likely now that me and the activists next to me have the exact same enemy. And that has shown up in a lot of different ways. We've had allies that are involved in criminal justice reform work. So that has been New Orleans for the community oversight of the police and Voice of the Experienced, or VOTE, which is made up of formerly incarcerated people. And they started working with us very early on. VOTE came in through the ceasefire work, and the ceasefire work really helped us build that coalition. That's like the foundation before the coalition formed. And now that same coalition is gearing up to start a push for a divestment ordinance again in the New Orleans City Council. And similarly with the port, there's now a community in New Orleans that's resisting development over its, you know, over their neighborhood at the port. The port is the one that's responsible for the agreement with the company. And so they've been actually the biggest people at the port meetings now and are increasingly becoming more and more militant as they're not being heard. And then finally, we've had an enemy. His name is Michael Hecht. He is the director of one of the organizations that's part of that initial agreement with the port of Ashdod in Israel. And he's also just a local supervillain. He was appointed by our evil governor, Jeff Landry, to be in charge of our Super Bowl efforts. His name was the Super Bowl Czar. And the city, we saw some of the worst ways in cleaning up the streets, getting homeless people, and like literally putting them in a warehouse that was also owned by the port. And he was the one that was in charge of all of this. And so now people who are unhoused people and people advocates for unhoused people's conditions are also alongside of us yelling at Michael Hecht. So yeah, we really thank the Palestinian resistance for all that they've done for the whole world.
All right, so in terms of the allies that we've built, I think it was also about recognizing that there are many ways to fight the U.S. war machine. So we had come out to weekly actions of the Coalition for Justice in Palestine, USPCN, direct actions. And this allowed us to build a relationship with USPCN and with their project BDS. We are working on this divestment campaign together. We also, during the march on DNC, not solely our idea, but the coalition decided to do lead-up mobilizations around every single demand. And so we had an action for International Women's Day. We had an action around police crimes, action around immigrants and workers' rights. And those actions allowed us to bring in organizations. And because the central demand of the coalition was to end USAID to Israel and stand with Palestine, it also allowed us to develop relationships with organizations and show how all of these demands are interconnected. We also supported student encampments, and so that allowed us to build with SJP and SDS. We supported a campaign for community control of the police in Chicago, which allowed us to build with CARPER. And then we also supported the Malaya to end U.S. support for Philippines. And so we saw common interest around working to curb funding for the U.S. war machine. I also just want to second the point about labor. We knew Green for Palestine, which is a caucus of AFSCME, which is federal, state, and county workers. They were initially pushing for Biden to call for an arms embargo, and because that didn't happen and because Trump got elected, they actually were looking for something to do on the local level, so we reached out to them. We provided a lot of education resources, and they were very interested in working with us, so we're building a relationship with them. And then in terms of how we built the movement around divestment, also want to second the point about action. At every single one of our meetings, we say that we don't have to be united in thought, but we have to be united in action. And so a few of the things that we've done, I mean, flyering, canvassing, stickering at every demonstration. We use Action Network, which is basically a free application that allows you to send emails to your target. So we've been blasting that. Constantly outreach to organizations. We put the petition link on our banner, which is, I think, is the second one on that wall. So we have that at all our actions. We see people taking pictures of it, and we see that growing our petition. And we've also recently been doing banner drops with our petition hanging over highways at rush hour. And the last one we did, it got us a boost of about 400 signatures.
All right, for the next question, you have like just over a minute each, all right? And we'll start actually with Lena this time as well. What have been your most successful actions? How have they captured the attention of your city?
Yeah, anything that gets the community showing up is a success in our eyes because it shows engagement with the campaign. Actions that get news coverage are also great because, again, it's helping us get the word out and draw more folks in. So as I mentioned earlier, the SBI's quarterly meetings are pretty huge for us. We've been able to pack these rooms tight and even keep them to ourselves for a little while to hold press conferences afterwards. We've also seen the campaign spread outside of our circle and often see people showing up to these meetings of their own volition, which is awesome. We've organized civil disobedience actions, one of which was occupying Tim Walz's fenced-in lawn the night before one of those quarterly meetings, and we were able to get a lot of buzz out of that. And we have seen that this buzz has reached the SBI because the press has started to ask the board members about our demands. They're being forced to engage and to give us answers. And even if these answers are bull, and they usually are, it still gives us more fuel for agitation and more opportunities to get people tuned in.
Thank you. So we kicked off our campaign at City Hall on the one-year anniversary of October 7th, and we've been planning escalating tactics to lead up to when City Council votes on its investment portfolio next month. So among our more successful actions are an ongoing letter, email, and call-in campaign, which we physically hosted twice, both times offering pizza provided by a local Palestinian-owned pizzeria. We had a solid turnout with many new faces who found our campaign through Instagram, the first time we even ran out of seats in pizza. So several guests have since become members of our org and have since joined our local divestment committee. Second time we did this was just a few weeks ago, and this time the pizzeria hosted our letter writing campaign, which allowed us to meet the owner and support his business in person. He also allowed us to hang our divestment flyer on his front door and leave additional copies at the front for his customers to take with them. And we believe this was a success because people liked engaging with the campaign on an interactive level. To have that creative and productive outlet to channel our frustration for our government's unconditional support for genocide. The front lines of a protest may not be for everyone, and this offers an alternative way for people to show up and take direct action and to wield the local power that we have.
Yeah, I'd say our most successful action in Detroit was on January 20th, wearing sub-zero degree temperatures with wind chill. We were the only group in our entire city to march, and I feel super proud of that. With over 60 people, we took to the street, and we made real demands of our city and how we were going to fight Trump from day one in office. And I feel really proud of that as the group we've made, that, you know, we didn't care that it was cold out. We didn't care that we were shivering. We brought the heat packs, shoved them in our socks, and we marched down the street. You know, we marched to the local district court. That was the same court that tried people from the encampment like myself. And then we won. And we decided to march there and show how we're going to win again under Trump, and how we're going to keep winning, and we're going to win divestment. So it captured the attention of our city because, you know, as I said, we were the only people who did anything on January 20th. So people really noticed, and we built after that again and kept, you know, very stable numbers up into the 30s at our meetings, and brought new people who wanted to come out because they realized if they wanted to be in a group doing something in Detroit, we're the group to do it.
The Anti-War Action Network calls to action have been some of our best actions. The Jewish Federation noise disruption was in response to the Human Rights Day call to action, and our October 7th action are both just spoken about very positively, even up till now. However, I would say our most successful have been the defense campaign work, which I talked about. We also, in early 2024, disrupted a conference called New Orleans Entrepreneurship Week that was put together by the people that are signed onto that agreement with the Port of Ashdod. And we had the student organizations at Tulane and Loyola join us for that. During the disruptions, ex-CEO of CNN and Tulane professor Walter Isaacson assaulted one of the disruptors who ended up being a Tulane student, which then led to an action outside of Tulane at their book fair the next week, where another community leader organizer was arrested defending that same student who was being targeted by the police. Basically, that whole series led up to the encampment and then the defense campaign after that. I'm sure the encampments would have still happened, but that was really important in increasing our focus in Tulane and showing how entrenched in Zionism Tulane is. So I would say that's been our most successful action.
I think our most successful action was an action we did in December. It was our first time targeting the Illinois State Board of Investments. And this was in part, I think, very successful because there was virtually no prior activity at the board, no public comments, no one even submitting public comments. And the board actually meets in this tiny conference room with absolutely no public seating. And so when we marched in 30, 40 people, they were panicking. We rallied outside. The staff were freaking out. They called the cops. They try to put us in a side room and we're like, hey, you can, you know, watch the meeting from this big TV. And we basically said, no, thank you. We're marching in. And so we actually ended up standing all around this conference room, giving public comment. We made them extend a public comment period. And I think it was just really impactful because it opened up a new arena of struggle and we're going to keep pushing on.
All right, sorry for making y'all rush, but y'all have such different and specific insights from your local context, and yeah, this is amazing, isn't it, guys? All right, so final question before we go to Q&A, and you have just under a minute for this one. What advice do you have for a committee thinking of starting their own divestment campaign?
I'd say the number one piece of advice is do not think that you need to be a financial expert before you start taking action. And in fact, it's taking action that will help you become a financial expert. And these two folks here with Anti-War Committee Chicago ended up going to a board meeting of the Illinois State Board of Investments and basically just said, we're students, we're just learning about finance. And they basically kind of helped us understand what is the physical environment in which we're going to have the action. They brought in a lot of notes and helpful feedback. And it was, you know, doing things like that that really helped us build the campaign. After every single time we did something like that, come back, reintegrate it into our campaign strategy, and just keep coming back stronger and stronger.
I would say we're a young organization. So first, I want to hear advice from others who have been doing divestment campaigns, especially y'all, on how we can mimic your efforts. But then I would say, like, from our experience, there's nothing stopping you from starting a divestment campaign. If you don't have one already, we just did a Google search and started it and people showed up. So, like, if you don't have, like, a Palestine solidarity movement that is very developed at the point that we were at, a divestment campaign, like, can be a really good vehicle to build a movement that will then increase the strength of the campaign. So, like, in the examples that I gave, I think our targeting of the initial Innovation Embassy agreement with the port of Ashdod had a lot of ripple effects that extended beyond a divestment campaign, but all of that came back to the campaign in one way or another.
Yeah, I'd say one of the biggest pieces of advice that we learned in Detroit is you got to give people a reason to care. You know, you got to build a community around your divestment campaign, whether that's having your teach-ins with a potluck there while you're talking through things and giving people a meal, whether that's having an art build for your protest, you know, right outside the city hall to, you know, point out how we need to divest. You just got to give people a space and a real political life that makes it feel like it's not just the org's campaign, but it's their campaign and they're a part of it and they're the one building it, or else you're just going to get churn and turnover. So yeah, I think that's our biggest thing of why we're able, you know, the 15 months after October 7th to keep our numbers high and keep our movement strong in Detroit is giving people a firm political life around the campaign.
So we have four key takeaways from our experience. One, think long-term. Two, remember that power for a popular campaign comes from the people. Three, genuine knowledge originates in direct experience. And four, do not get discouraged. So our spontaneous ceasefire campaign taught us that the majority of our council members are PEPs, or progressives, except for Israel. We understand that the odds of San Jose passing a divestment resolution next month are against us, unlike the truly progressive council members that make up the cities of Hayward and Richmond, which actually agreed to divest on the first try. So while we hope that it does pass next month, we also set realistic expectations with small wins that encourage us to keep going. And because if we look back to history as our guide, when the city of Berkeley, both the city and university, divested from South Africa, the divestment movement had been going 30 years strong. So even if city council dismisses our petition next month, we know they're going to vote again next year. So, and the year after that, and the year after that. And we will keep pressuring them until our city agrees to divest.
Yeah, echoing that, fighting for divestment is a marathon. Divestment from apartheid South Africa took decades. It's okay and good, actually, to start small. What ultimately matters in building these campaigns is that we're focusing on concentrated efforts that allow people to feel empowered, to take action rather than leading them to a sense of doom and defeatism. So find what that is in your communities and start having conversations with people. Table at events, banner over a bridge, have conversations with people, whatever your committee has the capacity to do. Just remember that divestment from Israel is a global campaign and that every effort everywhere is an important contribution to this fight.
All right, can we give it a big applause for all the people who are involved in these campaigns that made it a success?
Hi, my name is Philip from San Jose Against War. This question is for Lena. So I was wondering how you got more union involvement, because I think the unions around San Jose are really lib-coded, and I'm like, really trying to get, or like trying to think of ways to get them more involved with divestment and Palestine in general.
Yeah, I hope part of that isn't just that we're lucky, but I think starting with avenues where people might be more empathetic to what you're fighting for is always good. We have a lot of teachers who are in unions whose pensions are managed by the SBI, who, if you talk to them, I don't think teachers want their pension funds being invested in weapons manufacturers that are being used to indiscriminately slaughter school-aged children in Gaza. Just period, point blank. I feel that many of them are disgusted by that. So starting with those sorts of things and kind of opening that up, I do believe that most people don't want to be supporting apartheid. So finding allies that are there, and sometimes it's not the unions as a whole, but in Minneapolis, we have some teachers that do feel impassioned about divestment who are part of the, it's MFT, but I don't know what it stands for, but it's a group of teachers. So they spun off kind of their own little group that fights under that, but not directly connected to the union, and they're able to work with other people that also might be interested and grow from there. So I think it's finding nodes and giving them the resources that they need to continue growing that. Because if we know some people in unions, those people know more people in unions and can actually do that work.